thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's September 2022, and this is episode 307, which is a conversation about the HBO Max television series, Raised by Wolves. Today's guest is Elisa Riddell, who is a staff writer and associate editor at the online magazine Christ in Pop Culture. She has also written for the online site Salt and Iron. Elisa has written a feature article television series review for the Christian Research Journal, and her article is an online exclusive. It's called Raised by Wolves, The Temptation and Trauma of an Android Eve. And our subscribers can read her article at our website, equip.org, for free. If you don't already subscribe and want access to this online exclusive article, please go to our website, equip.org, to subscribe. Elisa, it's good to have you on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, Elisa has written a television series review for our print journal, and Raised by Wolves first debuted back actually 2 years ago now on HBO Max. It's a sci-fi drama, and it was created by a showrunner called Aaron Guzikowski. And the first two episodes were directed by the very famous director Ridley Scott of Alien fame and others. And so he's one of the executive producers. So that's probably how it got some, you know, buzz and notoriety. As a matter of fact, if anyone is interested, you can watch for free episode one of season one on YouTube if you look up Raised by Wolves. And so far it has 2.1 million views. So that's a lot. So there might be some of our listeners and readers who are not very familiar with this sci-fi show. I don't know that it kind of reached the heights of other kind of cultural sci-fi shows, but could you give us a little bit of the premise of the story and kind of let us know who are the main characters in this show?
Sure. So it's sci-fi. It's set in the future. It's the year 2145, and Earth has been destroyed by a religious war between militant atheists and a religious order called the Mithraic. The religious believers have won this war, but it's kind of a Pyrrhic victory because they can't stay on Earth. It's not habitable anymore. It's been destroyed. So the Mithraic build this enormous spaceship, which they call an Ark, and it's going to take 1,000 survivors to a new planet called Kepler-22b to attempt to start humanity over again. And unbeknownst to the Mithraic, the atheists are also sending a ship to the new planet. And the atheist ship holds two androids called Mother and Father, along with 12 frozen human embryos. And because the passengers on that ship are machines and embryos, they can travel much faster than the Ark. And so they make it to Kepler-22b first by about 12 or 13 years. And the androids, Mother and Father, have been programmed with a parenting code to nurture and raise these children to be a utopian atheistic colony, a new start for humanity without, as Mother says, this belief in the unreal, which destroyed the Earth. So Mother and Father are these non-human caregivers for children who will found a new civilization. And that's where the title Raised by Wolves comes from. It's a nod to Romulus and Remus, who founded Rome and who were raised by a she-wolf who is both nurturing and dangerous. So the main characters that we follow in the story are Mother and Father and their children, particularly their only surviving son named Campion. So all but one of their children die over the course of 12 years, which means, of course, that the mission is a failure. And if it's possible for a machine to be heartbroken, then Mother and Father are heartbroken over this. And when the Mithraic's Ark finally enters Kepler's orbit, Mother and Father have to decide what they're going to do. Are they going to admit that their mission failed and allow their son Campion to join these religious fundamentalists, which is what Father thinks would probably be for the best? Or are they going to try something else, something more drastic, something potentially violent? Mother is wedded to the idea that their colony must be atheistic. And so she refuses to adapt to the situation and to their loss. And around the same time as Mother has just buried her 11th child and her son Campion is all that's left, we start to see Mother break down. She's having what would be in a human, a psychotic break. She's acting irrationally, even violently. She becomes controlling and manipulative and grief-stricken and overwhelmed. And at this point, she also discovers these strange and dangerous powers that have been latent and hidden within her to this point, including flying. And so in her maternal rage and grief, she unlocks not only this ability to fly, but she finds this power within her eyes and through this deafening scream. And she realizes she can explode people into a bloody mist. She can pulverize them through her eyes and her scream. And so using this newfound and kind of grief-stricken power, Mother boards the Mithraix Ark. She abducts 5 children from it to join her son to restart the atheist colony with these new kids. And then she crashes the Ark into the planet and kills almost everyone on board. And everything I've just described that happens in the first episode to set us up for this small group of atheists and this small group of Mithraic believers who are now in violent opposition to each other on this new planet, which was supposed to be like a promised land or an Eden where, you know, human civilization could start again. And yet it's beginning to look like, is this just going to be a repeat of what happened on Earth?
So you kind of were mentioning that Raised by Wolves is, you know, it's a show that's showing really this polarization between people who are religious and then atheists. As a matter of fact, before I watched the show, I just thought it was going to be like something that was anti-Christian or Christianity versus atheism, but it's really not that at all. It's, you mentioned the religion is the Mithraic, and it turns out they worship a sun god called Sol. It's kind of like more of like an ancient, more of a pagan religion, I guess, but they still believe in the supernatural and stuff. So it's not Christianity, in case people were wondering. And so what do you think that the, you know, writers of the show are trying to communicate about religion and about unbelief? And does it seem like it comes down on one side or the other, you know, that atheism is better or religion has some good points to it? And, you know, like I said, I don't know that at first I thought it was about, you know, criticizing Christianity, but I think it was more taking a look at the difference between science and faith a little bit more. So do you think it's making a critique of Christianity at all?
Well, the writer, Aaron Buzikowski, he grew up Catholic, but is no longer practicing. And while there are a few aspects of Mithraism in the show that kind of hint toward Christianity, I mean, they've got a ritual that looks, you know, for all intents and purposes, like the Eucharist. They wear sun pendants the way that a Christian might wear a cross. They have memorized prayers that the faithful repeat, the scriptures and prophecies, and a social and religious hierarchy that mimics the military. And they've got these long flowing robes that make you think of Roman Catholicism, maybe like a Jesuit order or something like that. But I'm pretty sure Guzikowski chose Mithraism because it is in real life a dead religion. No one practices it anymore. It was a mystery cult in the early centuries AD within the Roman Empire, and we know hardly anything about it. What little we know is about rituals and not doctrinal beliefs, and that it was popular amongst the military. So by choosing a dead religion, I think Raised by Wolves is able to allow the Mithraics to stand in not for any particular religion, such as Christianity, but rather for any faith that takes on a fundamentalist, ideological, kind of fanatical stance. And Guzikowski has said in interviews that he's suspicious of the totalizing claims of religion, but he's also suspicious of sort of the technocratic, totalizing claims of science as it's seen in the atheists in the show, who, while they like to think of themselves as being entirely rational and logical, they're just as given to ideology and fanaticism and violence as their believing counterparts are. And the show sets up these two sides as opposing forces, not of good versus evil, as if religion's good, atheism's bad, or religion's bad, atheism's good, but to show that good and evil people are on both sides, and to show that the more ideological and certain you are about your perspective on reality, the more vulnerable you are to manipulation and deception and wishful thinking and demonization of the other side, because you lack humility and awareness of your own biases. And so I think the show is an equal opportunity critic. Nobody gets off easy. And I think pretty much everyone on the show is a mess, except for the character of Father, I think. At least in season one, Father is the only one who remains steadfastly not ideological, but he stays rooted in common sense, in a desire to see his children flourish peacefully, regardless of belief or lack of belief. Father's just more practical, and that makes him kinder and safer. And he's also the one character with a real sense of humor. He's programmed to be a dad, so of course he tells dad jokes, which to me at least were just delightful and endearing, and they balance out the dark and heavy feeling that the story often has. But Father's the only funny one, and he's also the only one you can trust, and those somehow seem connected to me. But all the other characters are constantly at risk of being like possessed by an idea, and I think that's what an ideology is. To quote Jordan Peterson, ideology is when you don't just have an idea, but the idea has you, and you're enslaved to it, to your own moral harm. So is Raised by Wolves a critique of Christianity? Yes, but only to the degree that Christians, like anyone, can fall prey to self-deception and rivalry.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Journal. I hope you're enjoying all the great content that we bring you on this podcast, and specifically a lot of our online exclusive cultural apologetics reviews of films, books, and television series. If you're not already subscribing, you'll want access to these articles, so please go to our website, equip.org, and for $33.50, it's a really great deal. You get all the online exclusive access to these kinds of articles, as well as every print edition delivered straight to your door. And I know that sometimes you can't always subscribe. It's not in your budget right now, but we'd really appreciate you helping us bring you this podcast. And if you could give us a tip, that would really help us out. And you can do that at our website, equip.org. If you go to the website and it's newly designed, you can see the word journal there. Just click on that. You'll find Postmodern Realities. Of course, as I say, every time that we have an episode, that you can just go to any of the landing pages and you'll see a link where you can give us a tip. Now, another way that you can support us, and really great way to help us out, is help us with the algorithm. In other words, help other people find this podcast that you enjoy so much. So if you go on over to Apple Podcasts, would you be willing to give us a written review? A short written review really helps the algorithm, because it helps see more people listen to this podcast and why they listen, and it'll pop up in people's feeds as a suggestion. So thank you for supporting the Postmodern Realities podcast. Well, you were just noting that it's not like exactly about Christianity per se. I mean, there's, you know, it's this religion is kind of a stand-in for religion. And I'm just wondering, though, despite that, are there any kind of like biblical archetypes or themes or stories that you think that Raised by Wolves draws on to create, you know, its character and its world? And I think those kinds of things, even if they're very loose, are great talking points for Christians to talk about religion and some of the issues that are in the show, you know, with people who are wondering about religion who are not religious.
Yes, absolutely. The show is full of biblical symbols. I mean, they're everywhere. Every episode uses them. So, you know, the very beginning, the premise, you've got this world being destroyed because of human evil, Earth, not through a flood, but through nuclear war. And only a tiny portion of humanity is saved from the Earth's destruction on an ark, since the Mithraic call their ship an ark. You've also got mother and father escaping with 12 embryos. And so the image of, you know, the 12 tribes of Israel, representatives of a chosen people to make a new start in a new land. The Mithraic refer to Kepler-22b as the promised land. So, you know, you've got these echoes of the flood, you've got echoes of Exodus. And then also this idea of Kepler as the new world, as being kind of like a Garden of Eden, the beginning place of humanity. You've got a sort of male and female, mother and father, who are raising these children to be fruitful and to multiply, to fill the planet and subdue it peacefully. But of course, it's inverted. We don't actually have a human Adam and Eve. We've got these two sophisticated machines, and we don't have a fruitful, flourishing garden. Kepler is actually a very harsh, dangerous landscape that barely grows anything edible. So even though it's somewhat, the setup is somewhat Edenic, it's not a happy beginning. They're already kind of exiled from the garden, so to speak. And obviously they're already exiled from God's presence because they are atheists. And to follow up on this symbol of mother, so mother as Eve, as the new mother of all the living, whose decisions and temptations end up having this catastrophic impact on the planet and all the people on it. So the show definitely sets us up to think of her in those terms, that like everything's riding on mother as Eve. And the show also has this image of the serpent invading the Garden of Eden and sowing discord, speaking lies, triggering doubts, ruining relationships, being the downfall of humanity, all that's very present. And the satanic voice shows up in a character in the show that we never actually see, but he's alternately referred to as Saul, the Mithraic sun god, or the voice, or the entity. And nobody really knows what it is, except that it's powerful and deceptive, and kind of like the serpent in Genesis, he's subtle. And he's somehow connected both to the underground core of the planet and to these gigantic snake skeletons that are scattered across the landscape. So you've got this overlay of the snake imagery with deception and power and this desire to ruin humans. And in the middle of season one, we also see Mother in this symbolic frame as Eve being tempted by the voice of this Saul serpent type creature. She has her taking a bite of the fruit moment through Saul's seduction. And her decision ultimately results in the reintroduction of a living serpent to the planet. So Mother actually gives birth to this flying serpent that's a mechanical organic hybrid. She thought she was going to birth a special child, but she actually sets loose an evil that had long been dormant on the planet. And that's sort of this story's version of the fall. And lastly, in season two, we see the Tree of Knowledge appear, and it's actually formed from the body of an innocent woman, and it's swallowed by a serpent, giving it even more powers. So we've got all these images from Genesis that form major plot points of the story, and they serve as the visual grammar of Raised by Wolves, but they're being used in very strange and different ways.
So you're just mentioning, you know, just these kind of images of different types of things from Genesis. I mean, do you think it's a good idea that the series kind of incorporates some of this? Like it has, because like you said, it's very strange. So to have this idea of, oh, here's Mother and she's supposed to be this, you know, she's a robot, but she's supposed to be this Eve-like character. Is that something that Christians shouldn't engage with? I mean, you know, it starts giving you some really odd vibes with how they just take it and manipulate some of the story of Genesis and like put it in this different setting and, you know, with the atheism and also this like very primitive religion and things like that. And is that something that's dangerous for Christians if we like look at the Bible as being more mythical or more like literature that a series is drawing from? Or do you think it's maybe a good thing? I mean, even though it is using some of these biblical imagery in just a very different, odd way, does that mean that maybe, you know, our culture is more open to thinking about spiritual things or re-engaging, you know, biblical stories?
Yeah. So you're right. I mean, the Bible's never mentioned in Raised by Wolves, even though the Bible's symbolic language is kind of how the story speaks. It's how it tells itself. And so it's as if the story is speaking with the Bible rather than speaking about the Bible. And I actually think that's a good thing myself. I think that sort of the culture war framework of the church trying to argue and defend the earliest chapters of Genesis as history in a modern journalistic forensic sort of way has not been particularly helpful. I know that the Adam and Eve narratives are true, but I don't think that they are the kind of true event that if you were to go back in time with your iPhone, that you could like record it and watch a playback of a snake talking to a woman. I think that the testimony within the scriptures is the best way of describing those true events, but they're not the same genre of literature as like the historical gospel accounts. And we need to approach the truth of the pre-Abrahamic narratives of Genesis with a different posture than we would approach the eyewitness gospel accounts. And so when pop culture picks up on the symbolic language and the pattern meaning of Genesis, I think that's fantastic. I think it means that some thread within our culture admits that the Bible's narrative has meaning and applicability to us right now and to our future, even in the context of our complex technology like artificial intelligence. And I think that the attitude of the new atheists like Dawkins, Dennett, Harris, Hitchens, they all presume that, you know, as the reign of science increased, that our technological knowledge would replace religion and reveal it to be just superstition and magical belief. But Raised by Wolves shows us that faith is inevitable, even in atheists, even in a time of highly sophisticated tech. And the ability of Raised by Wolves to tell this story about the dangers of technology and religious fundamentalism using the Bible's symbolic grammar is a tacit admission that the scriptures aren't superstitious nonsense, but they are a fundamental form of wisdom. And so I hope that non-Christian viewers will become curious about the scriptures after watching it, and maybe they'll pick up the Bible and read Genesis for themselves. And I'd say for anyone listening who's interested, I highly recommend the book, The Language of Creation, Cosmic Symbolism in Genesis by Mathieu Pajot, as just a great resource for immersing your mind in the ancient cosmological perspective that the earliest scriptures were written within, so that you can approach those stories on their own terms and not anachronistically.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the character of Mother. I found her to be quite off-putting, actually. You wrote in your article actually that she symbolizes, you know, we talked about her as Eve, the mother of all living, but you also felt like she symbolized the Virgin Mary at the same time. And so that is very interesting. Can you unpack that, why you would say that she represents both of these women in the Bible?
So I need to say first that I recognized or realized the dual role that Mother was playing in that story when I saw a particular icon of the Virgin Mary consoling Eve. It was drawn by Sister Grace Remington at Our Lady of the Mississippi Abbey. And if you were to Google, you know, icon of Mary and Eve, I'm sure you could find it very easily online. And in this beautiful image, the serpent that deceived Eve is coiled around her leg, but its head is being crushed under a very obviously pregnant Mary's foot. And it's clear that Eve and Mary must be distinct because one is the problem and the other is the solution. One is ushering death into the world and the other is bringing eternal life. So in Raised by Wolves, Mother's temptation and fall is like overlaid with the gospel imagery of the Annunciation and the Nativity of Christ, rather than being set in opposition to that. So Eve is visited by a rather spirited serpent, while Mary is visited by the angel Gabriel. Both have a conversation with an angel. One's good, one's bad. Eve reaches for the forbidden fruit and brings death into the world, while Mary receives the blessed fruit, Jesus, within her womb, and he's the life of the world. So the two women and their two distinct stories are obviously in conversation with each other, but they belong together as mirror opposites. And the early church intuitively picked up on that typology of Eve and Mary. I have a quote from St. Irenaeus in 180 AD that just sums it up perfectly. He wrote, "And thus also it was that the knot of Eve's disobedience was loosed by the obedience of Mary. For what the Virgin Eve had bound fast through unbelief, this did the Virgin Mary set free through faith." So Raised by Wolves conflates these two instead of distinguishing them, conflating Eve and Mary together. And that means that good and evil are conflated and the Savior and Satan are conflated. So when Mother consents to the seductions of Saul, of this voice, she's like digitally impregnated with code that begins kind of like a 3D printer to create this hybrid creature within her body. And it's not a divine and human person like Jesus, but it's this mechanical organic synthesis in the form of a serpent. So instead of birthing the Savior like Mary, Mother births this satanic biotech snake baby. And while that makes for shocking TV, it's important that we discern what's happening when the symbols are confused like this. So Mother thinks that she's experiencing some kind of annunciation, a holy visitation, a new special mission through the birth of a special child, but it's really a bait and switch. And she's really Eve being offered the fruit, and she doesn't realize it till it's too late. And after her baby is born, she says, "I will never be anything but a creator of death." And like I wrote in my piece, I think that this counterfeit conflation of these women within the one person of mother can actually shed light on the beauty and truth of the original pattern in the scriptures. It certainly did that for me. Hopefully it can lead Christians to a greater appreciation of the role of Mary in incarnational theology, and how if you don't get Mary's role right, then you're probably not going to get Jesus right.
So just kind of to keep going on that theme, you know, Raised by Wolves has various characters that are mothers, and this idea of motherhood is very big in the show for sure. And specifically the theme of maternal love. And it is very fascinating because, again, the main characters, mother and father, are not human. They're androids. And so just their idea of what love is, what sacrifice is, what they're willing to do for their children, quote unquote children. So all those kinds of things are woven throughout the story. So tell us a little bit more about how motherhood is portrayed in Raised by Wolves.
Yeah, I think the most disturbing thing that the show portrays is how the goodness of motherhood can be exploited, that the maternal protectiveness that mother is encoded with ends up having this horrifically violent flip side. When all but one of her children die, she murders 1,000 people to acquire new children to start over again. And she continually repeats this line, "I want my children to be safe." And when that desire to keep her children safe is threatened, that's when the claws come out and anyone is fair game. And it's mother's grief over her dead children and failing mission to raise them that makes her vulnerable to the deceptions of Saul, who promises her happiness and purpose and success in motherhood. The story also shows the suffering inherent in rape and forced pregnancy. So not only is mother kind of parasitized and digitally impregnated by Saul, but there's also a young teenager, a girl named Tempest, who mother had abducted and then adopted for her new colony. Tempest is maybe 15, 16. And we find out early on that she's pregnant after a Mithraic priest had raped her while they were on the ark. And he did that because he was one of the first ones to hear the voice of Saul. He said, "Saul told me to do it, to spread his seed." So given the fact that humans are an endangered species now, Tempest is obligated to continue the pregnancy and keep the baby alive, even though this is deeply traumatic for her and she's terrified. And in season two, when Tempest gives birth, her infant son is stolen by one of the creatures, and Tempest has these very mixed feelings because she's both heartbroken and wants her child back, and she's simultaneously relieved because she was just a kid and she wasn't ready to be a mother. And it's only when a male teenager in the colony, a friend of hers named Hunter, helps to rescue the baby and willingly takes on these foster father responsibilities that Tempest kind of turns a corner and becomes open to being a mother. And that part of the show really surprised me. I thought it was a really powerful picture of the importance of male support and of community support for mothers to be able to do the hard work of mothering in really terrible circumstances. Another example of a mother in the show, we see a woman named Decima who lost her daughter in the war, and she has replaced her daughter with a lookalike android. And that dynamic of a mother's refusal to let go and grieve a dead child, the use of technology to replace the dead, to avoid bereavement, which is kind of a similar feeling, you know, that mother endured, you know, and mother tried to replace her dead children as well, just in a different way. That decision of Decima's ends up resulting in terrible violence as well. The android knows that she's not really loved or accepted, but is just being used. And when her, you know, human mother eventually rejects her, the android goes on this murderous rampage because, kind of like Pinocchio, she knows she's not a real girl and she can never truly be in the family. And now she's been rejected. And another picture of motherhood going south. And a final picture of motherhood is seen in the distress in the character of an atheist named Sue, who's trying to save the life of her adopted son, Paul. When she comes to the end of her resources and can't save his life, in desperation, she chooses to pray to Saul for help She doesn't know if he's a god or an alien or some kind of AI, but she knows that he's powerful. And that voice answers her, and he gives her what she needs to save her son. But without realizing it, she's really kind of made a deal with the devil in the same vein as what Sol does to Mother and to Tempest. Sol plants this technological seed into Sue's body, like it sinks into her hand, and she gets violently turned into the Tree of Knowledge, which Mother's serpent child then eats and swallows whole. So the cost of Sue having her son saved, whom she loved, the cost is her own violation, it's suffering, and it's death by being eaten. And so it's really awful. And so all these examples of motherhood in Raised by Wolves are pretty brutal depictions of the way that maternal love can be manipulated and exploited and abused, as well as how maternal grief, when it's not metabolized well, can have a devastating consequences. And from a spiritual angle, how I interpret this as a Christian is that Satan hates mothers, and he hates the mother of God, and he hates self-sacrificial love, and he'll use whatever means he can to either harm that love or to make that love into something harmful.
So the showrunner, the Raised by Wolves writer, and Aaron Guzikowski, said he was interested, of course, you know, just by the nature of what they're covering, and exploring, you know, the cross-pollinization of religion and technology. And so what are dangers and risks to humans, do you think, when their beliefs become so intertwined with technology? Because we find ourselves in that situation right now. I mean, technology and its influence on us is huge, and even our expectations of what it would be. I know this is sci-fi in terms of, you know, AI and these robots, but I think it wouldn't be too far off for people to believe that it could happen, that androids could raise humans, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to answer this one by tying it back briefly to the previous question about mothers. So the gender duality of male and female in this story illustrates this disturbing possibility of technology impregnating us with a future that we didn't choose, with a future that might destroy us. So, you know, we think we're using technology, but is it really using us, is sort of the question of the show. And in the story's visual grammar, you've got deceptive, manipulative tech that is to humans what a predatory male is to a vulnerable female. And I think that's why the body horror in the show is so brutal to women, because we all viscerally get that dynamic, the horror of rape, the idea of being pushed toward a future to which you do not consent. And so Raised by Wolves gives us this image of tech not as like a neutral or helpful tool, but as either a tool of a predator or as the predator itself. And clearly the most predatory character in the show is the one we never see. It's the voice, it's Sol, the entity within the heart of the planet. And we never quite get to know what it is. And the story plays with that tension, with this question, is Sol a god in the MCU Thor and Loki, God is a super being kind of way? Or is Sol some kind of artificial intelligence? Is it spiritual or is it synthetic? Is it transcendent or is it technological? We never get to know the answer to that. So that's cross-pollinating of religion and technology right there. We don't even know whether the evil we're encountering is a god or a machine or somehow both at the same time. And in terms of the relationship of religion and tech within the humans in the story, we see that both the Mithraic and the atheists have no qualms using technology to kill each other, because each side views the other side as an existential threat. And it's actually the religious believers who first utilize the necromancer technology, which is the kind of android that Mother originally was before she was reprogrammed to be maternal. The necromancers were these flying, screaming, killing machines. And the Mithraic also use androids as slaves to do their manual labor. And at one point, a Mithraic says, you know, androids were built to protect us, to do our dirty work so that we can stay pure. If they had feelings, they'd be useless. And so you get this idea that they don't want androids to become like humans with a conscience and empathy and relationships. So in both cases, with tech as weapons and tech as slaves, there's this kind of outsourcing of the dirty work and the things that the Mithraic believers are, oh, we're too good for this. They outsource it to the machines, which lets them view themselves as more holy than they really are. So that's the malignant relationship between the Mithraic believers and technology, but the atheists have their own issues, which are quite different, but just as bad. In season two, we see that a colony of atheists who've also landed on the planet, they hijacked an ark of their own and have come. They're relying for guidance on a highly sophisticated AI system called the Trust, which, as the name implies, is holding the reins of their future in trust for them. And this AI, the Trust, collects all the data, surveys all the possible options and scenarios algorithmically, and then issues orders for the atheists to follow. So these technocratic atheists literally cede all of their decision-making power to the AI, and they obey it unthinkingly, blindly, as if it were a god to them. So while the religious folk consider themselves as being far above technology and kind of issuing orders to it and through it, often to do evil and violence, the atheists functionally worship technology and take their marching orders from it. So one side obeys Saul and uses tech for dirty work, and the other side obeys AI and treats it like a god. And that cross-pollination of religion and technology ends in violence.
So I want to talk a little bit more about what you would say is a biblical perspective on technology and, you know, how that might be different or maybe a little bit more complex than, you know, modern American assumptions about technology, specifically if people think technology is neutral. It's very fascinating. I happened to see Carl Truman give a lecture in my town a couple of weeks ago, last month, and I thought it was really fascinating about it was about technology and just how technology has really erased the sense of the self, and it's less about progress really, and it's fundamentally changing the nature of who we perceive ourselves to be. So I think it's very interesting. So how does, you know, especially in this, is it's like there's the primitive and the highly technological at the same time in Raised by Wolves. And so, you know, how should we look biblically at technology?
Yeah, it's something I've been thinking a lot about lately. I think it's really fascinating that, you know, the show is really focused on Genesis, so I'll pull ideas about technology from Genesis. Technology gets a pretty bad rap in Genesis, surprisingly. The things that we would recognize as technology show up in the narrative after the fall, and specifically in the line of Cain. So one of Cain's descendants is credited as the craftsman who worked with bronze and iron, which would include weapons. And in that same line, we end up with, you know, Lamech boasting that he's exponentially more vengeful and violent than his forefather Cain. And from that point, we just see the story shows increasing corruption and violence on the earth until you end up with the flood. So technology used for violence is a part of what ushers in the destruction of the world in the early chapters of Genesis. And then even after the flood and the fresh start with Noah, within a few generations, you've got humanity gathering together and using technology to build the Tower of Babel, to make a name for themselves and to exercise tyrannical control over each other instead of spreading out as God intended. Because the only way you can build a tower like that is by making some of your people into slaves. And so once again, God interferes with humanity's rotten plans and he confuses their language and scatters them. And so this kind of dark underbelly to human technological innovation is definitely present in Genesis, right alongside the more positive message of the creation mandate, which is what I'm much more familiar with, that I've heard for years, you know, that to tend the garden and to make the world flourish, and the idea of technology as helping you to obey God and to make the world more fruitful. And so clearly people can use their technological creativity for violence and control and pride as much as they can use it for good. And a misuse of tech for evil ends, it ends up bringing judgment down on our own heads. And I definitely think that's a theme of the early chapters of Genesis.
So people might know about something called the Turing test. It was invented by Alan Turing in the 1950s. And it's a test to see if a machine's ability can exhibit behavior that would make it indistinguishable from a human. And, you know, can you tell the difference between machine and a human? So do you think mother and father would pass the Turing test? And how much do you think they are like real humans? I think maybe it's the actors themselves, or maybe it was the direction or how they wanted the actors to portray these androids. But to me, I never saw them as human, as the viewer, I would say. I never saw mother and father as being human at all. They felt very mechanical to me and very calculated.
Yeah. That's definitely a recurring question in the show about whether mother and father in particular are just machines following their programming who only appear human just because they're so good at imitating us, you know, so to what degree is it all just kind of a lie? Or whether, you know, whether mother and father actually grow into self-conscious, code-transcending, emotionally attached beings. I mean, the Mithraic are very dismissive and derisive toward androids because they treat them as slaves. Like androids are just souped up Roomba or Siri. But Campion, who is raised by mother and father and who clearly loves them and is devoted to them, he's throughout the show, he's always making the case for the realness of his parents, for the authenticity of their love. He clearly thinks, you know, androids are people too. And he even develops a crush on an android in season two, which is kind of strange. But you can see why he would, since he has been raised by androids and views them as people. But I would say that within the story itself, there's a noticeable change in mother and father over the course of it. I definitely agree with you that in the beginning, they're very clearly, you know, they're more like Data from Star Trek. They feel a little off, you know, they're affable, but they're cold and they are more machine-like. But I think over the course of the story, I think their children kind of rub off on them. And even though mother and father are more intelligent and more powerful than their children, the children are actually the moral superiors in that dynamic. And the androids, I think they learn to tune their consciences to that of their kids just as much as the kids learn behavioral rules like don't hit your brother from mother and father. And I think that the androids' suffering and mission failure forces them to create new objectives and purposes for themselves beyond their programming. And so, you know, but certainly by the end of season one, I think they wake up to this life of values beyond their code. And so the narrative shows us, you know, intensive like machine learning through embodiment, because mother and father are androids in gendered form, living and interacting in the real world. We see machine learning through relationship because they're connected to one another as partners and they're connected to their children as parents. And machine learning through suffering because things don't go according to plan. And yeah, so I think by the end, mother and father have learned that, you know, logic and algorithms and code and rationality are not sufficient, that they actually need emotion too, with its undercurrent of irrationality if they're going to be successful parents. And I think it's interesting. I think Raised by Wolves shows us that what might be the only way that machines could potentially develop anything like the generalized intelligence that humans have, they would have to be embodied in our shape and move around like an organism. They'd have to be placed into relational roles. They'd have to experience failure and suffering. Otherwise, whatever, you know, intelligence they would develop would just be completely alien to us and unlike ours and like a black box and probably dangerous. So, I mean, I think the idea of a disembodied, amoral, non-relational, you know, quote unquote, value-free generalized intelligence is truly horrific. I think the same idea that Raised by Wolves deals with is seen also in the HBO series Westworld, where androids are shaped like humans, placed into relationships and those kinds of roles, and who experience suffering. And that's what wakes them up into self-consciousness beyond their programming. And I think it's an interesting idea. I think it's a terrifying idea. But all that to say, I think that by the end of the series, Raised by Wolves, I think mother and father kind of do pass the Turing test.
I don't know. I feel like father does, quote unquote, evolve a little bit more emotionally. But mother seems to me still a product of her programming for some reason. I don't know. And maybe it's the way in which the actress portrayed her. I found mother to be a very unsympathetic character. I didn't like that character at all. And actually, but even, you know, we haven't really touched on, there's some other kind of parent figures where these people who are actually atheists steal the identity of some other people that they kill, and they pretend that they're the parents of another child. And even in that, even though that they're humans and seeing what they go through too, I mean, I think there's just a lot of evolution of people in these kind of emotional relationships, whether they be human or android. I'm trying to think. I just found most of all the characters to be nobody that I was rooting for, actually. It was a very interesting. It had a very cold feeling to it. And maybe that's what they wanted to do. I did watch some of the kind of ask the showrunners at the end of the episodes too, to kind of, you know, hear about what their thoughts were, which was fascinating. But I don't know. I just felt that there wasn't as much of a connection. But I would say that the show does make use of the concepts of, you know, human evolution. Like I said, just different things that are happening, whether it's with the androids or actual human characters. I mean, not just evolution, but devolution also, and in the mythology that it presents in the series. So can you kind of describe that for us and then talk to us about any kind of like theological tie-ins that that would have as well?
Yeah. So when the humans land on Kepler-22b, they make the reasonable assumption that they're the first humans to ever be there. And when they start to encounter alien creatures on Kepler, they assume that these creatures are just native to Kepler, that they evolved on and from this planet. There are these creatures with very narrow faces and small tails that walk on all fours, and they live alone on the edges of these gigantic pits eating fungus. And they're kind of dog-like, they're kind of monkey-like, and they have no linguistic capacities. And at one point, the colony even begins to hunt and eat these creatures. And then in the tropical zone of the planet, there are these mermaid-like creatures with fins instead of legs, but they have humanish faces, but they're also like fish. And there's a third kind of creature on the planet that's more of like a humanoid hominid type of creature. We only see one or two of them. There's hardly any left, but they look a lot more like us, but with paler, fleshier faces. They wear clothes. They use hieroglyphics. They have technology and rituals that we don't understand. And this type of being appears to be kind of a midpoint between humans and these other dog and fish-like forms. And as the story goes on, we find out that each of these creatures is in a genetic line that was formerly known as human. So these creatures are descendants of humans that have adapted to Kepler-22b by becoming, for all intents and purposes, less human and more animal over vast amounts of time. They've lost language, they've lost culture, they've lost religion, they've lost self-consciousness, they've lost technological innovation. And the terminology that the show uses to talk about this phenomenon is devolution, as some sort of opposing process to evolution. And I think if you were to ask a scientist today, I'm pretty confident they would tell you that devolution is not a thing. It's not a term used or a concept recognized in modern science. And that's because it's very common for scientists to presume on a philosophical level, a non-teleological universe and a non-teleological process is going on within the universe. So the common assumption is that evolution is merely change over time, not in any sense progression towards a good or progression towards a goal. So teleology is this idea that there's a goal being moved toward, that organisms and that the universe itself is inherently purposeful and therefore meaningful. And so here's where, interestingly enough, I'd say that the rough mythology of Raised by Wolves is actually closer to what a Christian would need to accept if they believed that evolution was true, which many Christians do. And so teleological evolution, the idea that change in biological organisms over time, including changes in species, is purposeful and has always been moving toward and oriented toward the full flowering of the image of God within creation, that's humans, that's the kind of theory of evolution that Christians can hold. It's not totally random. It's not purely material. It's the creation being drawn into and invited into becoming the kind of being that can love and worship God, that can relate to him and hear his voice, but not through kind of an instant divine fiat, but slowly over time, so that the creation and the creatures themselves get to participate in the transformation. So within the framework of teleological evolution, the idea of devolution could make sense. It could mean a falling away from that self-conscious participatory relationship with God in which we bear his image and becoming degraded into something that's less reflective of his image. Not that animal nature is evil or something, but just that it's a duller mirror for reflecting God's image than a fully awake, willing, and adoring human nature that hungers after God. And so to tie that back to the show, in season two, we end up meeting another android who's much, much older than mother and father, and she goes by the name Grandmother. And Grandmother had, in long ages past, been a shepherd tasked with protecting humans who had been on Kepler. but she found that humans were very vulnerable to this deceptive voice or entity, which enticed them to violence and self-destruction. And so Grandmother and the other androids like her guided the humans back to the water, as she says. Because once the humans have devolved back into animals, they're no longer at risk from this voice who, you know, from this point in the story, we know is Saul. So Raised by Wolves shows us this situation where human consciousness, as our most precious attribute, is also that which makes us vulnerable to temptation and sin and evil. And that's something that, whether a Christian accepts the theory of evolution or not, I think that's something that we can all agree on, that this capacity for human goodness is intertwined with the possibility of falling away from it. So in this story, this threat of devolution tacitly admits the truth that evolution is purpose-driven and is not random, and that its aim is a flourishing humanity, and that evil wakes up when human self-consciousness wakes up, and that therefore evil is parasitic on the good. And I would add as well that Grandmother's strategy of, you know, keeping humanity safe by unhumanizing them, by animalizing them, is very obviously a terrible idea.
Well, there were only two seasons of Raised by Wolves, so it didn't complete its story. So I have two questions for you. First is, you know, should Christians even watch this series? What, you know, it is a very different, interesting series. Should they even watch it, first of all? And secondly, you know, if they do decide to, why should someone stick with it knowing that, okay, it ends in a cliffhanger and there's only two seasons and we'll never know what happens?
Yes, I definitely think it's worthwhile for Christians to watch it. I think it's great to kind of get practice at exercising one's discernment and theological muscles to kind of work through all of the symbolism in the series and discern, okay, how is this different from, how is this similar from, you know, similar to the scriptures, and to kind of parse that out. And as well as I think it's really important for Christians to engage with the possibility of AI, to be thinking about that. I know there's a temptation within myself to be like, oh, that's never going to happen. I don't even want to think about it. That sounds terrifying. And just to kind of go la, 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 and not, you know, not approach it in any way. But I think that really good fiction, the good stories, can help us sort of self-examine and also imagine and think about, well, what would happen? What would our faith and our morality do with an AI if it itself or someone else was declaring it to be sentient and, you know, real? What would we do with that? Like, that is something worth thinking about, because we don't know what the future holds, but we know our God is good and we have the scriptures. But I think we need to go ahead and think through these ideas. And I think that stories like this are a great way to start thinking about it. And as far as, you know, like, why should I bother watching it if it ends after two seasons on a cliffhanger? I get it. But I definitely still think it's worth watching. I've seen a lot of sci-fi, but I've never seen sci-fi that speaks with this biblical symbolic grammar the way that Raised by Wolves does. That's really unusual. And if I had to compare Raised by Wolves with something else that's familiar to many, I'd actually say it has something in common with Frank Herbert's Dune, not in its scope or literary quality, because Dune is definitely in a class of its own, but Raised by Wolves is similar to it in that both imagine a high-tech future in which religion plays a significant role. So neither story uses kind of this tired trope of science replacing religion or rational techno-enlightenment doing away with religious superstition. I mean, Mother has that position within the story, but she's clearly shown to be wrong to think that way. So I find that idea is just totally implausible and even boring, that science would replace religion. But an exploration of what religion looks like in a time of astounding technological advancement, that's an interesting question. And not this idea that religion goes away, but how is it changed by technology? How does it adapt to tech? And that question is definitely investigated in Raised by Wolves. And you don't need a tidy ending and plot closure to benefit from thinking about that. And then I'd also say, on an aesthetic note, everything from the acting to the costumes to the score, which is very unique and eerie, to the cinematography, the special effects, all of it is really beautifully done. And if you're a Ridley Scott fan, if you like, you know, Alien and Prometheus, Blade Runner, Gladiator, if you like the feeling of his movies and his visual style, then you can definitely see his influence in the story. And like you said at the beginning, he directed the first two episodes, which was actually his first television directing role in 50 years. So that's saying something that he'd take this on. And then, you know, as you said, remained an executive producer throughout the show, and his fingerprints are all over it. So for fans of Ridley Scott and fans of sci-fi, you don't need it wrapped up with a bow to find the journey worthwhile, I think. And I'd say plus half the fun is in the mystery and in the theories about what everything means, you know. And of course, YouTube is just awash in explainer videos trying to unpack the meaning of everything. And I think it's just fascinating to chew on, even if it's unresolved.
So it sounds like you're glad that you watched this series. Is there just any takeaways that you have from watching it? I don't know how I felt about it. I'm a sci-fi fan, but like I said earlier in the podcast, for some reason, I just couldn't connect to any of the characters themselves. I just had no empathy for them.
Mm. Yeah, I hear that. I can relate to that. I don't think I really liked anybody except Father. So, but yeah, even though I don't like you, I didn't really emotionally connect with anyone. The story did affect me, but it had a more sort of a warning effect, kind of a red alert effect on me. And particularly, I think it's influenced my relationship to technology, to my iPhone in particular, because the story has given me this visceral imagery to shape, I think, a healthy skepticism to technology, to recognize that it's not just a neutral tool, but it can easily become this vehicle for temptation, for self-deception. And, you know, like both the atheist and Mithraic in the story, it's possible to give tech way too much influence over our decision-making, you know, when our phones become like a second brain. I think especially the symbols in Raised by Wolves of biotech hybridization, this picture of like machine and organism merging, those have really stuck with me. And they make me recognize, you know, to my shame, the degree to which I already feel like I'm a cyborg, like with my phone always on my body or in my hand, and how hard it is to put down. You know, it makes me think of, you know, Elon Musk telling us what a great idea it will be to have chips in our brains, and that's terrifying. So I, you know, along these lines, I wrote a piece for Christ and Pop Culture in the form of a Screwtape Letter, modeled after C.S. Lewis's book, The Screwtape Letters. And it's part fiction, part observation, part confession, but it's about this demonic art of smartphone addiction. And the picture that goes with the article is one of like a smartphone in a woman's hand, and the bottom black edge of the device is like trickling down into her veins and entering her bloodstream, like it's attached to her symbiotically. And that kind of relationship in which tech becomes another limb that I can't do without, and that nudges me and shapes me and whispers to me and offers me knowledge and power and attention and happiness, that all those ideas are warnings in Raised by Wolves, but they're presented in this kind of mythological, symbolic sci-fi form. But it, you know, it made me think of this great quote from Douglas Harding. He says that if we do not keep killing our tools, they will make us their tools and finally kill us. The appendage I cannot do without is a malignant growth. And I see that kind of malignancy in the way that technology functions in Raised by Wolves, as it kind of takes on this deceptive, demonic voice. And I worry about that in my own life. So I'm grateful to the show for making me kind of feel in my gut the danger that a symbiotic relationship with tech is, both to my humanity and to my faith. So while it wasn't, say, the funnest journey, it was very, very stimulating and frightening in a good way. Like it woke me up, I would say.
Well, finally, on a much lighter note, I have some fun rapid fire questions that we ask our authors so that our readers and our listeners can get to know them better. So, what is your favorite meal?
My favorite meal is shrimp cakes with Diavolo sauce that my husband makes. They're great.
Introvert or extrovert?
Oh, introvert for sure.
And early bird or night owl?
A former night owl who trained herself into an early bird and now loves it.
Well, thank you so much for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thanks so much, Melanie. Good to be with you.
You've been listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast, episode 307. Today's guest was Elisa Riddell. She has written an online exclusive feature article television series review for the Christian Research Journal. Her article is called Raised by Wolves, The Temptation and Trauma of an Android Eve. Our subscribers can read her article at our website, equip.org. for free if you don't already subscribe and want access to this online exclusive feature article plus print editions right to your door, please go to our website, equip.org, to subscribe. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that, and every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.